Clive Myrie at Christmas
starts this afternoon from 1.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Walter March is a Hollywood legend. He's won 3 Oscars for his sound and editing work on Apocalypse Now and The English Patient, and his credits include some of the most acclaimed and discussed films of the past half century: The Godfather Trilogy, The Conversation, The Talented Mr. Ripley. He co-wrote the first movie George Lucas ever directed, the dystopian science fiction drama THX 1138. As an editor and sound mixer, and the only person to win Academy Awards in both categories, he's thought deeply about the craft of cinema and all its possibilities, ideas which he shared in his book In the Blink of an Eye. Walter, we're going to hear music by Wagner, Beethoven, Pergolesi, but first a waltz by Chopin.
Yes, I grew up in Manhattan, in the neighborhood of Columbia University, and the peculiarity of that neighborhood was that it was the first in New York to be equipped with electricity. But it was direct current electricity, so when I was born in 1943, I lived in a 20 or 30 year lag from everyone else who now had alternating current, which meant that our apartment still had a literal icebox, and it had a wind-up record player playing 78 RPMs. My father's family was very musical. All of his brothers were conductors or pianists or singers. His mother taught music until she was 99 years old. He rebelled and was a painter, although he had learned how to play the violin. He exhibited at Betty Parsons Gallery, where Jackson Pollock and Franz Kline and famous abstract expressionist artists showed, but he painted what was known at the time as magic realism, precise but mysteriously evocative still lifes. My mother loved music, and she particularly loved Chopin. And so my earliest memories are listening to her Red Label recordings of Simon Barrère playing Chopin.
Hearing music at that age, we now think, has quite an extraordinary effect on children.
I think so. She would sing to me while I was still in the womb, My Darling Clementine. And still, to this day, when I hear that song, I get a very strange feeling. But yes, I was being pickled by classical music before I even knew what that was.
Well, let's take the top off the pickle jar and begin with the Chopin Waltz in A-flat, Opus 42, number 5.
Thank you.
Simon may not hold the record for the fastest piano playing, but he certainly comes close.
Walter Murch, you mentioned your grandmother teaching music until the age of 99, and I wonder whether she taught you.
She didn't, although her influence was profound. I had a decisive educational moment with music when I was 7. The music teacher was introducing us to music, and as a preliminary, she said, "Does anyone here know how to play the piano?" And in fact, my grandmother had taught me how to play chopsticks. So I raised my hand, and she said, "All right, Walter, come and play." So I played chopsticks. I was very proud of myself. And she paused after and said, "That's just chopsticks. Anyone can play chopsticks. Jack Mulligan, a fellow student, come and teach the class what real piano playing is like." And Jack, age 7, knew how to play some of Bach. So I sat down, humiliated, and thought, oh, music, it's about humiliation. And who knows, it could have pushed me away from music for quite a while.
On the other hand, perhaps this early exposure to music in your family had something to do with the skills you then developed as an editor, which after all is all about timing, silence, when not to have silence.
Yes, absolutely. And not only picture editing, but I'm also a sound mixer, sound designer, re-recordist, whatever we call ourselves, where you're sitting at the equivalent of an organ, these master boards full of tens of thousands of different parameters that you can control, which is a kind of music in itself.
Music clearly holds a continuing magic for you, and I think particularly in terms of the next choice.
Yes, our apartment was electrified with alternating current, which happened in 1950. Suddenly, there was this surge of appliances, one of them being a record machine. It was a little portable machine that you could close up and take with you. My father and I went down to Canal Street, the Tottenham Court Road of New York at the time, and brought it back with a record, which my father had chosen carefully, Ferdy Groffé's Grand Canyon Suite. It has a, I want to say, childlike appeal. It's simple, but it's dramatic. Ferdy Groffé was the orchestrator for George Gershwin, and this was one of his ventures into composing.
Well, we're going to hear Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic in the Grand Canyon Suite, composed by Ferdy Groffé, On the Trail.
Thank you.
Probably soothed some of the wounds inflicted by my music teacher, because I played that track over and over and over again. I probably ground down the record to dust over the course of a couple of years.
It's very filmic music, isn't it, Walter?
Extremely
Murch?
Filmic.
That's... I thought I heard Tom and Jerry almost.
Yes, it's faulted for that. It's too picturesque, but for a 7 or 8 year old kid, it was perfect.
Is it true that as a kid you had a rather unusual nickname?
I was called Gerald McBoing-Boing or Walter McBoing-Boing because of an animated character named Gerald McBoing-Boing, who was very popular in the early 1950s. He had a defect, which was that he did not learn how to speak words, but he could communicate through sound effects. the sound of a car, meaning he wanted to take a trip, or the sound of a ice cream van saying that he wanted an ice cream. And I similarly did not hesitate. If I didn't know a word, I would simply make the sound of the thing that I was trying to say. So I was sensitive to sound from an early age, maybe because my ears stuck out even more than they do today. And it was about this time that tape recorders became commercially available. A friend of mine's father had one. I would go over to his house and play with it and convinced my parents that we needed one because we could record music off the air and we wouldn't have to buy records, an early form of pirating, I guess.
That's a very good example of children bribing their parents.
Yeah, exactly. So aged 12 or 13, a tape recorder came into our lives, and I've lived with tape recorders and their digital equivalents ever since.
Pierre Henry next, an experimental French composer who became fascinated by the integration of sound into music. I wonder when you first heard this and what went through your mind, Walter, when you were listening to it.
Yes, I came back from school one day, turned on the radio, and this was playing over WQXR, which was the classical music station in New York. And I thought, how did one of my sound collages get onto the radio? Because it sounded initially just like the kind of things that I was experimenting with. So I recorded it and listened avidly to find out what it was, and it turned out to be this example of musique concrète. I was amazed and gratified that here were French people, sophisticated French people, doing what I was doing as a teenager.
Well, this is Prosopopée, number one, from the beginning of Pierre Henry's Symphonie pour un homme seul, performed by the composer.
I suppose that's the musical equivalent of Jackson Pollock.
I was thinking exactly the same thing.
Maybe, or maybe Paul Klee.
But it's all creating what you're telling us, a sort of jigsaw which explains exactly what you ended up doing. Because I think of you, in a way, as being a sound sculptor.
Yes, that's a good definition of cinema itself, discovering the visual sculpture of the film and then finding ways to have the sound sculpture that runs alongside it, not exactly duplicating what the picture is doing, but commenting on it and underlining it and then departing from it and then coming back to it.
Prosopopée, number one, from the beginning of Pierre Henry's Symphonie pour un homme seul, performed by Pierre Henry. You went on to get a summer job at a church radio station.
Yes, I was 18. And a radio station had started up in Riverside Church, which was a couple of blocks away from our apartment. My mother was a secretary at the church, strings were probably pulled because of my fascination with tape recorders. A radio station at that time was a place filled with tape recorders, which was a delirious experience for me.
Your work at the radio station involved cataloguing music, and I think that informs your next choice.
Yes, one of my jobs was to catalog their record collection. And to entertain myself, I thought, well, here I am with basically the history of classical music. I'll learn everything from the start. So I started at year zero, which was, in musical terms, probably the 11th century with Gregorian chants, and gradually worked my way forward in time. I had a fascinating illusory experience while doing that, because after 2 weeks of this, I had barely gotten out of Gregorian chants, but I was still in the world of what they call Pythagorean tuning, and I had to go up to the control room, and my ears were assaulted with what I heard as chaotic modern music. I thought, this radio station doesn't play that kind of music. And I asked the engineer, what is this music? And he held up the cover of the LP, and it was J.S. Bach. You know? And in one story of Stairway, I had traversed 400 years of musical history.
It's fascinating to think that Bach could sound modern and new. But let's actually go back to the Gregorian plain chant that you were listening to.
Yes.
Some of which has a wonderful quality of spareness.
Yes.
Resulte la.
really does conjure up cathedrals and flying buttresses, doesn't it?
Yes, you can think of almost no greater contrast between that kind of music and Pierre Henry.
We heard Gregorian chant from a setting of Vespers for the Holy Trinity performed by the monks of St. Peter's Abbey in Solesmes, one of the great centres for Gregorian chant. You're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3, where my guest today is the film editor and sound designer Walter Murch. You enrolled in the University of Southern California's film school, Walter, where you met many people who would go on to become actually very successful filmmakers, including George Lucas. What impression did he first make?
The first meeting was in the dark room. We were developing still photographs, and I was washing one of my photographs in hypo, as they said, and a voice behind me said, "You're doing it wrong." And I turned around in the dark red illumination and looked at this kid who was several years younger than me and shorter, and I thought, what does he know? Well, it turned out he was right. I was doing it wrong. And that was the beginning of our friendship, which endures to this day.
This next question could easily elicit an encyclopedic answer from you, because I wanted to talk about the extraordinary significance of music and cinema.
There has never been a marriage so quickly consummated as film and music. They fell in love with each other from the year dot. You can think of them as yin to each other's yang, the picture being the yang element. It's very insistent, and music is more yin. Each one relieves the other of its obsessions, in the sense that the virtue of music is that it's the most abstract of arts, but maybe you can take that too far. And putting pictures to the music gives a solidity to the music itself. And the same thing applies the other way around, that pictures have a specificity to them, and when you play music with them, you get a sense of the universality of what's being shown.
I'm always struck by how utterly significant music is. For example, if you see a woman walking up a lonely path to an isolated church, the music will tell you whether she's going to meet her lover or her murderer.
Yes, you can take that too far. And certain films by my friend George Lucas take that too far. I just finished remixing The Sound of American Graffiti. It's a wonderful film, and there is music for 92% of its whole length, and the same thing with Star Wars. There are very few moments in Star Wars that don't have music. On the other hand, The Godfather, which I worked on the soundtrack for, has many sections which don't have music. In every film I work on, I try early on to identify three or four places where I can reduce the soundtrack to silence at an unexpected moment, which throws a kind of a hot potato in the lap of the audience, where they have to figure out for themselves, why is there no sound?
You use this in The Godfather, in the scene where Michael Corleone kills for the mafia for the first time.
Yes, the decision by Francis Coppola and Nino Rota, the composer, was to have no music during the so-called assassination scene, but to save the musical moment for maximum impact after it is over, where there's an almost operatic piece of music that comes in. The whole scene is played in musical silence, and yet what we wound up doing was repurposing the sound of an elevated train to come in and go away and come back again slightly louder and go away and come back in again even louder, and then at the climactic moment just before the assassination to bring in not only the rumble but the screeching of the metal wheels like Bernard Herrmann in Psycho.
But also like music concrete, which
yes,
you're saying.
Yes, so it is interpreted by the audience as not music. It's a sound effect that is presumably in the air of this restaurant in the Bronx, but it functions emotionally on the audience as if it were a piece of music.
Do you feel that a composer like Beethoven, who in fact is your next choice, has a cinematic quality to his music?
Not only does he have a cinematic quality, I think that he is one of the fathers of cinema. in the sense that composers of the previous generation, Haydn, Mozart, followed a template for their music, which you might call choreographed music, music for the dance, or architectural music, in the sense that each movement of the music, the composer introduced the audience to a room of a chalet or a castle, and musically they would reveal all the wonders of this room while staying in the room, and then bring that movement to a close, and you would go into the next room, which had a different architecture. And Beethoven took that and threw it all away, because his inspiration was nature. He loved walking in nature, and nature is full of huge contrasts. He was beaten up for this critically at the time.
They called him cacophonous.
Yes, one of the French critics listening to the Pastorale said, "He fills the soul with sweet melancholy and then shatters it with a mass of barbarous chords. He puts doves and crocodiles together in the same cage." Which you can almost define cinema as an art that puts doves and crocodiles in the same cage. But the entire 19th century was dominated musically by Beethoven, people either imitating him or reacting against him. So by the end of the century, everyone was used to this doves and crocodiles. And when cinema came along in the 1890s, it naturally fit together with that. And I think it's one of the things that explains why cinema developed as a craft, a business, and an art so quickly. It took barely 10 or 15 years for it to become the form that we know it today.
Well, nothing illustrates your point better than the Pastoral Symphony, which includes lightning and a thunderstorm.
if you listen to Beethoven, you can see the grammar of cinema evolving. He has jump cuts, dissolves, over-the-shoulder repetitions back and forth, close-ups of single flowers, so to speak, and then shows you a vast landscape. So people's brains, I think, were rewired by Beethoven. So when cinema came along, that was one of the things that cemented the marriage.
You were telling me before we started recording of a wonderful happen chance. And
yes.
A remark you made fired some of the neurons in George Lucas's brain, didn't
right.
it?
Right. We were doing the final mix changes on American Graffiti. 2 o'clock in the morning, George was asleep, and I was communicating with the machine room over the intercom. I asked for R2-D2, which in cinema speak meant Reel 2 Dialogue Track 2. And that woke George up, and he said, "What did you say?" And I said, "I didn't say anything. Go back to sleep." He said, "No, you said something." And I said, "Okay, yeah, I asked for R2-D2. And he mumbled, "What a great name." And the rest is history, so to speak, because he was writing the script for Star Wars as we were doing this final mix on American Graffiti.
That's a lovely story. One of the films you worked on, THX 1138, a dystopian science fiction film, you co-wrote with George. In fact, it was his directorial debut.
Yes, and one of my responsibilities was to temp track temporary music for the film. So I ordered up a bunch of records, and I would put them on tape and then play the tape backwards and slow it down or speed it up. One of the pieces of music that I did this to was Pergolesi's Stabat Mater, and that turned out to be the music for the title sequence of THX 1138.
Pergolesi might well have thought that the Stabat Mater was Dolorosa if he'd known what you were going to do to
yes.
his music.
I apologize to Pergolesi.
Well, here it is as he meant it to be heard. Pergolesi's Starbuck Martin Dolorosa with Sandrine Piau, the soprano, countertenor Christophe Lowry, and Le Talon Lyrique, conducted by Christophe Rousset. I imagine you quite like hearing it the right way around.
Yes. The composer of the music in THX is Lalo Schifrin, and he said, "I love the music for this film. I'm just going to simply transcribe it into musical notation, and then we'll re-perform it with the Warner Brothers Orchestra and Chorus." So in a weird way, all of my temp tracks were transubstantiated into fleshly music by Lalo Schifrin.
You were Oscar nominated, Walter, for The Conversation, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. It stars the film Gene Hackman as a surveillance expert who makes audio recordings and stumbles on a murder plot. So the sound design must have been central to that film.
It was. Francis said, "Well, this film is about a sound recordist and you're a sound recordist, so why don't you edit the picture of the film as well?" So I was happily saddled with both responsibilities.
Very memorably, you worked with Coppola again on the Vietnam War film Apocalypse Now. You edited the film and received an Academy Award for Best Sound. Wasn't there something like over 1 million feet of film to edit?
There was 1,250,000 feet of film, which is 200 plus hours. But I was not the only editor on the film. There were three, sometimes four editors working simultaneously. But I was responsible for the mixing and the sound design of the whole film.
Whose idea was it to use the Valkyries at the beginning?
John Milius, who was the original author of the screenplay.
It was difficult to get the rights for that, wasn't it?
It was very difficult at the very last minute. We got so used to this particular recording, which was the Schulte Vienna Philharmonic 1966 recording, that we just thought, well, that's part of the film. But somebody in administration was doing due diligence and said, "Wait a minute, you don't have the rights to this." So we petitioned Decca, and they said very quickly, "No." And we tried again, and they said, "Double no." So then panic set in, because it was basically 2 months before the premiere of the film. I had another kind of musical education here, because I took Schulte's recording and every 5 seconds noted his tempi, which varied kind of below the radar, where you think he's being regular, in fact he's not. And I would listen to all of the other 18 recordings of the Valkyries and try to see if we could readapt one of those other recordings. One of them came quite close, which was Eric Leinsdorf LA Philharmonic recording. I transferred it to 35mm magnetic sound, put it up against the picture, and it actually, for a few minutes, looked like it might work. And then the disaster happened, ironically, not because of any problem with the tempi, but because of the musical coloration. Schulte had emphasized the brasses at the point that Leinsdorf emphasized the strings, and this worked against the images in a kind of synesthesia way, and I had to call Francis and say, "It's not going to work." So he redoubled his efforts. He actually got through to Sir George and immediately got the thumbs up. He said, "Of course, dear boy, why didn't you call me in the first place?"
Did you have fun getting the helicopter's sound together with that marvelous Valkyrie? And
yes.
It just fits like a glove.
Yes, it does. The added twist of this is that the music is being played through tannoy horns sticking out of the side of the helicopters. So we were able not only to play with it editorially, but to kind of swirl it around. And we were working in what became known as 5.1 sound for the first time. In the mixing of all of those sounds, which included weapons and voices and helicopters and the music, obviously, there came a point where it all congealed into a solid mass where you couldn't hear anything. And so I invoked one of my principles, which is only to throw 2 to 3 things at the audience at the same time. So even though we might be inside the helicopter, you don't hear the music at all. You just hear the voice and the sound of the blades. And then 5 seconds later, the music comes back. And if it's done deftly enough, you think the music is continuous. You think the helicopters are continuous. You think the weapons are continuous. But in fact, they're not. So I'm playing a game of spinning plates in the mixing.
The Ride of the Valkyries, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by George Scholte. You stand to edit your films, don't you, like some orchestras now?
I do. I jokingly, but not so jokingly, compare film editing to music conducting, short order cooking, and brain surgery. And all three of those require you to stand, because time is important in all three. And when you're standing, you are more kinesthetically engaged with the rhythms of what it is that you're doing.
We go back to early music, Walter, for your final choice, Couperin.
This is a piece of music that I discovered maybe 15 years ago from a YouTube recording. It's a performance by Grigory Sokolov, the Russian pianist, called the Tick-Tock Chuck, written by Couperin for a dual manual.
A harpsichord, in fact.
A harpsichord, yeah. And yet here is Sokolov playing on a single manual piano, and the director of the performance made the decision to concentrate just on his hands. And after 30 seconds or so of looking at it, you believe that those hands are another separate creature who is playing this amazing dexterous performance, kind of like a butterfly during a mating ritual or something. And somehow listening to and particularly watching him play had an instant calming effect, which I think, you know, is one of the main attributes of music, which is it has an ability to put us on a more even keel emotionally.
Well, you've certainly put us on an even keel today. So as we listen to a live performance by Grigory Sokolov of Le Tic Toc Choc by François Couperin, it only remains for me to say, Walter, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Le Tic Toc Choc by François Couperin, a live performance by Grigory Sokolov at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in Paris in November 2002. It was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the film editor and sound designer Walter Murch. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael will be talking to the botanist and chief executive of UK Research and Innovation, Dame Ottoline Leiser. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. The United States has stepped up pressure on Israel to prevent civilian deaths in Gaza, saying it has a moral responsibility to do more. Israel's been carrying out renewed airstrikes in the southern city of Khan Yunis after the collapse of a week-long truce with Hamas. An advisor to the Israeli Prime Minister said the country's military is making the maximum effort to avoid Palestinian casualties. Anti-terrorism prosecutors in France are investigating an attack in Paris last night in which a German tourist was killed and two people, including a British man, were wounded. A suspect was arrested. He told police he was upset because Muslims were dying in Gaza. The Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer's praised Margaret Thatcher for trying to drag Britain out of its stupor by setting loose our natural entrepreneurialism. Writing in the Sunday Telegraph, Sir Keir says she was a prime minister who'd brought about meaningful change. The Home Office says more than 500 migrants crossed the Channel in 11 small boats yesterday. The French authorities rescued a further 190. The number of people making the crossing this year is down by about a third compared with last year. The Health Secretary, Victoria Atkins, has said her top priority is to avoid a winter crisis in the NHS. The seasonal rise in diseases such as flu always increases the pressure on the health service, and last year saw ambulances queuing outside hospitals before their patients could be admitted.
Health ministers from dozens of countries are meeting at the UN's climate summit in Dubai. It's the first time the annual event's dedicated a day to public health. Delegates want to find ways to deal with extreme weather, disrupting food supplies and driving the spread of disease. Members of the ASLEF union are taking part in a series of rolling one-day walkouts in their long-running dispute about pay. Avanti West Coast, Chiltern, West Midlands Railway, Great Northern, London North Western Railway and Thameslink are not running any services today, and they've warned the disruption is likely to spread into tomorrow. And the weather: outbreaks of rain across Wales and England, drier with a few coastal showers elsewhere, and brighter for Scotland. Temperatures peaking at 8 degrees Celsius in Cardiff, 7 in London, 5 in Belfast and 1 in Edinburgh. That's BBC News and weather. It's 2 minutes past one.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
Invest in some me time and wind down from the day with a classical mixtape. A 30-minute soundscape of classical music to wash away all of life's troubles.